From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The U.S. unemployment rate hits a 25-year high. Will the stimulus package start reversing this alarming trend, or will the efforts be too little, too late? Car makers are running on empty, and the healthcare industry is struggling. How do these sectors affect the health of the overall economy? And Chris Brown remains free on bail as he faces two felony charges in the assault of girlfriend Rihanna. It is the Reporters Roundtable. Joining us now, Deirdre Childress. She is the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend magazine, and Ernie Suggs, who is a political and urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Ernie, Deirdre, nice to have you back.
Thanks, Tony.
Let's start
Hello,
here.
Tony.
Let's start here in the unemployment line where so many of us are. It seems like every time you open a newspaper or turn on the TV, there's more bad news about the economy. This morning, we woke up to reports that the economy lost more than 650,000 jobs in February. The national jobless rate now standing at 8.1%, the worst in a quarter century. So, Ernie, the president is under a lot of pressure, of course, to start creating jobs under the stimulus package. But here's my question. He's got several plans on the table, from the stimulus to bank bailouts to health care reform. Is any of this going to start reversing this trend, and when?
I think it will, but it's going to take time. I think, as you said, President Obama has a lot of apples up in the air right now with the health care, with what's going on in Detroit with GM, and their proposed bankruptcy. So he has a lot of apples up in the air, and I think that it's going to take time. He came into a situation unlike any other president, perhaps since FDR, with an abysmal economy and an abysmal forecast on jobs. So I think it's going to take time, but I think that with all of the apples that he's throwing up there, I think something's going to stick. I think the stimulus package is going to work. It's going to take a little time.
Well, Deirdre, the White House also points to the ailing healthcare industry as part of the puzzle to our financial woes. The president held a White House health summit to come up with ways to overhaul the medical industry, and he opened the gathering by laying out the reasons that he is calling for reform.
In the last 8 years, premiums have grown four times faster than wages. An additional 9 million Americans have joined the ranks of the uninsured. The cost of health care now causes a bankruptcy in America every 30 seconds. By the end of the year, it could cause 1.5 million Americans to lose their homes.
Do you think that the public is buying the idea that reforming health care is going to help the economy?
I think the public has all come in one voice, in unison, to say that our current system is a failure. And I think that because we've all acknowledged that it's a failure, anything he can do to give us a different system, to give us a different take on this issue, seems to be the way that the direction that the administration needs to go. I think what's going to be clear for the president is that he has to be very careful in this area. One thing he's doing that I think is very positive is listening to people. I think the summit that they had yesterday, the talks that he's having as he travels across the country, listening to people and what their needs are, is going to be the most important way to come up with a comprehensive package that affects and improves the lives of most people. I think that he has to be very clear that he's not repeating the mistakes that diverted the Clinton administration from getting some reforms in this area.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. I was going to suggest that to you, as a matter of fact, Ernie. He's staying away from the name Hillary Clinton, and the new face of this reform is going to be Kathleen Sebelius, presuming that she's confirmed. What does she bring to the table?
Well, I think she brings experience. If she's going to, if she's going to be an advocate for it, I think the last thing I heard is that she wasn't at the meeting yesterday because she stayed in Kansas to take care of some business in Kansas. But I think that she can be a very good advocate for this. But I think that this is, out of all the things that Obama is talking about, this is going to be one of the toughest challenges. Deirdre mentioned that he is looking for feedback from all these different constituencies, but I still think the insurance companies, I just read or saw this morning where some conservatives are launching a very, very big campaign against this. So I think this is still going to be a huge battle that, again, it's not going to be done quickly and overnight, if it's done at all.
Let's move on to another topic. Of course, one of the biggest stories outside of Washington may be the case of the state of California versus Chris Brown. The singer appeared in court in L.A. yesterday to face two felony charges and an alleged assault on his girlfriend, Rihanna. Now, his arraignment was postponed until next month, and he remains free on $50,000 bail. But, Deirdre, the issue seems to be this. Court documents say he pummeled Rihanna repeatedly in the face and the arms, even bit her and allegedly threatened to kill her. Now, she's reportedly back together with him and did not ask the court for a restraining order against him. What do you make of that?
I hate to say that I think Rihanna's making a mistake on this, because I think that the message she's sending to young men and young women is that this kind of behavior can in some way be explained or condoned. And I think that's the wrong message to give to our young people in particular. I think young men need to know the consequences of their actions. And I think Chris Brown is about to feel some of that. And I hope he's an example to other people who are suffering through this issue. And I was a little let down by her reaction in terms of getting back together with him, accepting his gifts, and sending a message to young people, in particular our daughters, that this is acceptable behavior.
It's pretty awful
when you read about bloodied mouth, and the whole exchange in the car that's alleged to have happened.
It's certainly a matter, in a sense, of is it not, Ernie, public behavior versus personal behavior. You know, we had Judge Lynn Toler on recently discussing this very matter, and she said it was the responsibility of the state to press the case, whether the victim did so or not. But many people seem to think that Rihanna has a responsibility here. What do you say?
Well, I think it's the case's state ultimately, because you're going to have a person like Rihanna or any woman who is stuck in this kind of situation, who's going to backtrack or who has the potential to backtrack. So I think it's very important for the states to advocate for women. And not only if we take Rihanna and Chris Brown out of this whole situation, this is going on right now as we're speaking. Some woman is being abused by a man. And I think it's incumbent upon states and local governments and local prosecutors to convict these men and to prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law so that it doesn't happen again. Because you are going to have cases where, and we have seen it all the time, where women are ultimately killed by men that have been arrested before who have beaten them. And we have to take it out of their hands somewhat. And, again, it's not about Rihanna and Chris Brown. This is about the whole, class of women who are being abused by men.
Well, let's flip the script for a moment to talk about the responsibility that Chris Brown may have in all of this. He's reportedly taking anger management classes. Do you think, and this will be the last question on this before we move on to another topic, do you think, Deirdre, that this is a sincere effort on his part to reform, or simply a show to stay out of prison and save his career?
Oh, I think it's a genuine effort. I work with entertainment news, and I think that given his background in history, his mother's own history of some abuse by his stepfather, I think it probably just really came home to him what he's done. And I'm not excusing it, but I think that reality has set in, and he's going to be facing the consequences. I think that when you step back from something like this and look at photos and what your behavior was, I'm pretty sure that he's a contrite individual. But I like the fact that he's going out and seeking some help with it, because it seems to be a deep-seated problem for his family.
All right, talking.
If I can jump in very quickly, I don't think it's sincere at all. I think he's doing it because he was caught, and if he's probably beaten her before, he's probably done things to her before. He was caught. He wants to rehabilitate his image. His managers and producers perhaps told him to do this, and that's why he's doing it. He's not, this is not sincere at all, in my opinion.
Well,
I don't know Chris Brown.
It'll be interesting. None of us do, personally, and we'll have to wait and see how it turns out. Let's end Reporters Roundtable on this with another person who is facing consequences for his actions, not physical, but certainly verbal. I'm talking about Chairman Michael Steele of the Republican National Committee. Now, some people within the committee are asking for his head on a platter. We all know about his brouhaha with Rush Limbaugh, but just the other day he said that the GOP needed to go on a 12-step recovery plan. I guess my question to you, and I'll put it to you, Deirdre, is, does he talk too much?
I'm not sure that he talks too much, because he is the chairman of the party and he needs to be out there. I think it's the way that he speaks. I think that this whole criticism he's facing about saying bling bling and my bad and some of the black vernacular he's using in his speeches, I think that's what's getting to people. And then I think maybe he needs to temper it and work with his tone a little bit. I think he tried to do that Wednesday following all of the backlash that occurred after his appearance on D.L. Hughley's CNN show. But I think a lot of the message needs to get out there. That's his job and his responsibility. But I think it's about the tone and the approach, and I think that's what's getting him into trouble.
Well, you know, it got Howard Dean into trouble in a sense, and I'm wondering really quickly with you, Ernie, is he toast, political toast now?
I think he is. I think this has been a horrible first couple of weeks for him. You know, the apology to Rush Limbaugh, the letter from the woman from North Carolina who I covered when I was there. You know, it's just been a horrible week. I mean, horrible first couple of weeks for him, and I think he's pretty much done. Even if he doesn't leave the office, I think his specter there has been so watered down and so tainted that he's not going to be effective as the leader of the party.
All right, we'll have to leave it right there. I appreciate both of you coming on. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Great job.
Deidre Childress is the editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend magazine and the National Secretary for the National Association of Black Journalists. She joined us from the Audio Post studios in Philadelphia. And Ernie Suggs is a political and urban affairs reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and currently a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He joined us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Filmmaker Lee Daniels burst onto the scene in 2002 as producer of Monsters Ball. He followed that critically acclaimed film with The Woodsman, starring Kevin Bacon as a convicted child molester adjusting to life after prison. At this winter's Sundance Film Festival, Daniels took home the top prize for his latest effort called Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. He recently sat down with NPR's Allison Samuels to talk about his craft. She began by asking about his broad body of work and how he views it.
I think that cinema was really created to as a medium for people to escape the reality. You know, and it's become so overwhelmed with the escapism that we fail to oftentimes see the reality. I think that through reality, we can get cured. We can cure ourselves. Each piece of work that I work on helps me to become a better man. And there's something that I learn from every project that I have worked on. So it really, doing film is therapeutic for me. It's like my own shrink.
Well, with a film like, say, The Woodsman, what the therapy of that, because that's the one that moved me, you know, as much as Precious. It was just so, you know, you feel for this person who, you know, it's basically a pedophile, but you also feel for, you know, his struggle to get better. Yeah. What kind of character, what about that character sort of got to you?
Well, I think the reason originally that I did the piece was is that it was so well written. It always starts with the word, and I loved the writing of the script. Mm-hmm. But I think that even deeper than that, I never understood why my mother said, when we were growing up, she would say, oh, you can't go out. You can't spend the night at so-and-so's house. And we really were, there were six of us, and we were secluded. We really weren't able to play and spend the night out at people's houses. And I didn't understand until much later, you know, that she had been touched and early in her childhood. And she was so paranoid about that for us. And I think that one out of four Americans are... babies are sexually abused, and I think that we choose to ignore it. Okay. We completely choose to ignore it. One out of four. That's a lot. That's a lot.
No, that is. You know? That definitely is. So now, when we come to the film Precious, which again will not be out till later on this year, but it has so much buzz, what about that particular character drew you in?
Just the truth of what she was about. Precious is a young lady who's 16 who's trying to read. She lives in Harlem. She's illiterate. And she's trying to read, and she's overcoming every obstacle that's thrown in her way. She's heavy set, and she's not what one would perceive, you know, here in America to be the ideal girl. And she overcomes every obstacle to learn how to read, and also she's pregnant for the second time. And she gets just about, it's about triumph. It's about hope and dreams and triumph.
When you, talking, going back to the thought we were talking about, we talk about films and you make films that are very thought-provoking. How hard does it make it from that point to actually get that film made because of sort of the themes? Is that ever...
Part of the evolution of filmmaking for me is always raising capital for film to tell that truth that people rarely want to see, like with Monsters Ball, who really wanted to see a movie about a little fat boy that's killed in an interracial story in the South and stuff. Nobody really wants to. But then we do want to see it because the numbers show opposite.
Now, this film, most of your films you've done have been, I would say, mainstream. Does this film have...
Mainstream? What do you mean mainstream?
Well, when I mean mainstream...
Mainstream? A movie about pedophiles?
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, the cast has been very...
Shadowboxer?
Well, the cast has been very mainstream. Let me just sort of say it like that. The cast has been very mainstream.
Okay.
I feel like Precious is a little more...
To the left?
Yes. And I was wondering, you know, was that something you thought about, that this has a more African-American theme in some ways?
Right.
Or did it...
Well, it is an African-American story, but it's a universal story. I mean, that's the genius, I think, of the writing, mm-hmm. that it affects so many people on so many different levels, you know? And that's the beauty of Precious,
That anyone can relate.
Yeah.
Okay.
It transcends race, gender, religion. It really does hit home because everybody's got a little Precious in all of us.
In this economic climate, have mm-hmm. you found it to be even more difficult?
I'm in a place right now where that I think that studios are more accepting of what it is that I have to offer. I think they're really, you know, they're getting a clue about what people want to see. And that's a great thing. It's a great thing. Studio executives are way smarter now. They really get it. They get what America wants. It's easier for me now.
To do it.
As a filmmaker, too. I mean, come on. How many times I got to do a movie?
Right. You know what I mean? Right. You've proven yourself, I think. Now, the film won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. What
yes.
was that like for you? Because I saw it on your Facebook page. You announced it to everyone. What was that like for you?
Allison?
Yes.
I can't describe it. It was a... because, well, the audience award was what really shocked me because that the people spoke. And I didn't think that it would sort of play well to... I didn't know that it would play well to that sort of sector of people in Utah. Because this is an African-American sort of... Though it's a universal story, really, it was the first time testing it in that world outside of the African-American box. And it was shocking. I was very humbled by it, and it made me feel really great. And also, there was a camaraderie with other filmmakers that were there that had worked just as hard. And that happened one. So there was a unity that was there, and I felt humbled to be with such talented people.
Tyler Perry and Oprah have teamed up to distribute Precious. Is that correct?
Woohoo.
Yes, okay.
To present it.
To present
Same
it.
Different. Yeah,
okay.
To present it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Oprah obviously makes perfect sense. I mean, I totally see her being drawn into this. Tyler Perry, though, you know, has a different brand of filmmaking that seems totally opposite of yours. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say, or...?
No, I think that we're all both African-American filmmakers, and I think that, you know, as with African-Americans, we're individuals, and I think that he has a different perspective than me on filmmaking, but I think we unify as filmmakers, and I think that it's a beautiful... I'm so blessed that he is, you know, he's doing this twirl for me, because oftentimes, you know, the types of cinema that I do with mm-hmm. my voice don't reach his voice. And I think that he helped me. He hooked me up. You know, he said, "Come on, let me get my audience to see your work." And I think it will educate a lot of people. And I think that this movie will educate a lot of people that I wouldn't ordinarily reach because of Tyler.
Lee Daniels' new film is called Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. It recently won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and will be released later this year. Lee joined us from the NPR studios in New York. Mm-hmm. "You're pretty for a dark-skinned girl." That is an unfortunate comment that many African-American women of darker hue have heard at one point or another in their lives. But now that we have a woman of color in the White House, will Michelle Obama's presence in magazines and on TV put dark skin back in style? NPR's Allison Samuels discussed the issue with Joel Wade. He is a professor of psychology at Bucknell University and has written extensively on the dark skin, light skin issue. She also spoke with Shelley English Figaro, who recently wrote an article on Michelle Obama making dark skin stylish at mommytracked.com. Allison started by asking Shelley what inspired her to look at this topic.
Well, I'm going to tell you what inspired me was eavesdropping on a conversation had by some high school students, some African-American middle-class high school students who were friends with my son. And one of them said, "Dark skin is back in style." And I was stunned.
Okay. Now, you and Michelle are about the same age. You both have children, both attended an Ivy League school.
Right.
What was your experience like as a darker-skinned woman navigating the classroom, the boardroom, and the dating scene? What was that like?
No bed of roses, that's for sure. I went to an Ivy League university in the 80s, and I can vividly remember being at the Black House, what we called the House for African-American Studies, and where we had a lot of our parties. You know, many of the brown girls and the dark girls sort of standing around waiting for a dance, you know, and the guys walking straight past us, you know, into another room to, you know, pluck up the you know, lighter-skinned girls who were sitting clearly not wanting to dance at that time.
Right. But that's where their attention was. That's
absolutely
where they were headed.
I can vividly remember that. And that happened often. And actually, I stopped attending dances just because it was just simply not worth it.
Well, let's bring in Joel Wade. You've written about this stuff for so many years. Is the root of this dark skin, light skin debate still lie in the aftermath of slavery, or is there something else going on here?
Well, I think that plays a large role, maybe even the largest role, that there's such a history with it. And I think also that you still have some individuals that aren't necessarily aware of that history. Plus, when you couple that with most of our icons of beauty and power, et cetera, that are African-American by and large, or at least the ones that tend to generate the most exposure, tend to be fair-skinned. So I think unconsciously, African-Americans are still affected by it because they just don't get a lot of exposure to dark-skinned individuals that are considered beautiful, that are powerful in positions of power. So,
well, now, is this a global problem for women of African descent, or is it really concentrated mostly in America? Is this where it really hits the hardest?
Well, you do see it in other areas, but I think it's stronger in America, and I think part of the reason for that is because in some of the other countries where you have a larger African population and you have Africans of all different hues and darker skin tones in positions of power and in the majority, I think it's less of an issue in those areas than it is in the United States.
Now, how does the stigma that is attached to being a darker-skinned woman play out psychologically? How does that, you know, sort of, I can imagine it plays havoc with a young girl's self-esteem.
Yeah, it's actually gotten somewhat better because the emphasis on dealing with the skin color issue has focused more on women, African-American women, than men. So it's not as bad as it used to be, but it can have mental health consequences for some African-American women.
Okay, because I was going to ask that, too. Does it affect men as much as it—do they struggle with it the way that women do?
No, I don't think the effect is nearly as strong among men. And actually, what the research tends to show today is not a very big effect on overall self-esteem of men or women. That is, they seem to feel good about themselves, but it tends to have a bigger effect on the question of whether or not other people would find me appealing. That is, am I attractive? Am I worthy of of being considered beautiful.
So many children are growing up, and particularly young men, well, children in general, African-American, are growing up with their mothers, only their mothers.
Mm-hmm.
When they have a mother that's dark skin, or insists that are dark skin, but they're still only exposed to on television like Beyonce and people like that, how does that work? How does that affect their sense of what beauty is?
Well, I think they can still be negatively affected. I think a lot depends on, I would think, the relationship between the individual and their mother or their parents. But one of the things that happens too is children and other individuals see images on TV and they sort of detach them from their real life in one sense, in the sense of, well, I'm not going to apply these negative characteristics to my mom or my sister, but I will judge other women or other people by these standards, but sort of insulate the self from it.
Well, it's very interesting because I have this conversation a lot where I have I sometimes cover the NBA, and when I go into the locker room and see the wives, they're interchangeable in many ways because they all look alike, and these guys are coming from all types of backgrounds. Mothers look totally different, but it's almost like there's a memo that goes out that this is what you have to date. And I sort of feel like there is that in peer pressure, I guess,
mm-hmm.
on young men, if that's fair to say, to sort of follow suit, particularly the more successful you are.
I think that's true. I think there probably is some overt pressure, but I think there's also some covert or you could say unintentional pressure, just some mm-hmm. unintentional conformity, where if all the other people you see or who are in a situation like you are mm-hmm. doing this action, then we tend to mm-hmm. fall in line behind them. We tend to do the same things because we just assume if all these other people are doing this, it must be the right thing to do. And so I think in some cases it almost becomes an automatic behavior.
Right. Also, I mean, that's who is desirable. That's who is portrayed as desirable in
yeah.
terms of those in those circles. And
yes.
other circles. So and if you're an NBA player and you're a desirable man, you're going to want to pick a spouse or a girlfriend who would be seen as desirable.
Yeah, there's a kind of a calculus or you could call it a kind of buying and selling that goes on, where if fair skin is considered beautiful and kind of a high-value asset, and if you're a wealthy, say, a wealthy athlete, you're now sort of on par with that other high-valued asset. So you're now able to, as you pointed out, attract someone that you could not attract before.
Right, okay. And it's interesting because these guys have great relationships with their mothers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They love their mothers to death, but they, you know, marry someone who's the complete opposite
and
looks and everything else. It's very interesting. Now, 4 years from now, when Obama is coming to the end of his first term or whatever, do you expect we still will be having this conversation? Is this a conversation that's going to just sort of go on and on in the black community?
Well, that's a good question. I think it may go on for some time. It would be nice if it didn't continue, that is, we were able to get beyond this. But I think given the history of it in this country, it may take a lot longer than 4 years. But certainly 4 years of being exposed to someone who does have a darker skin tone, I think will be helpful.
Okay.
I think that we're making great strides. I think we are a lot further along than we used to be.
I would agree.
Well, thank you both for talking to us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
That was NPR's Allison Samuels speaking with Shelley English Figaro. She recently wrote an article on Michelle Obama making a dark skin stylish at mommytract.com. We also heard from Joel Wade. He is a professor of psychology at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania and has written extensively on the dark skin, light skin issue.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Even some hip-hop fans won't play the music for their kids. Especially if you're listening to the radio, you don't know what kind of language or lyrics you're going to get. But poet Nikki Giovanni thinks hip-hop is critical for children. She's put together poetry and hip-hop that's suitable for young ears. It's called Hip Hop Speaks to Children, a celebration of poetry with a beat. Our own Tony Cox got a chance to sit down and speak with Nikki Giovanni about putting a spin on children's lit.
Allow me to introduce myself. They call me the showstopper the dime dropper, the spin move to the left, reverse jam popper.
This is a multimedia book. And so we have the poems and we have illustrations, which are fantastic. We have a CD, and then we have, I think, 34 tracks on that CD. So we wanted to bring a whole package so that, you know, an 8-year-old can sit and watch and listen to it. But more, because I'm a parent, my son is old now, but I wanted a book that if my kid was younger, I could look at it with him and learn something and recognize what's good and what's maybe not so good, what I would let him listen to and what I would prefer that he didn't.
I wasn't sure what to expect, and then when I opened it and read it and listened to it, it's wonderful. How'd you come up with this idea?
Hip-hop is a legitimate artistic form, and it just appeared to me that there was a hole in the market someplace, and it seemed to me that parents wanted to say to themselves, you know, should I let my children listen to this music? Well, this is wonderful music, and you can't let some of the other ends of hip-hop determine, you know, how we look at it. So I wanted to put a book together that I thought gave us some historical foundation, taking it back to its origins and bringing it up to essentially, Tony, the future.
One of the things that was really interesting about it, even for me as a person who sometimes cannot figure out what is being said in hip-hop, the lyrics in here make it really clear. And you have so many different people. I see Kanye West, A Tribe Called Quest. You have Queen Latifah. You got the old Sugar Hill Gang. How did you decide who to put in here and who not to? Because it's such an eclectic mix.
Well, there was no way to get everybody. But we actually wanted to start with the origin of the vernacular. But hip-hop, being a vernacular, goes back to opera. So we went back to the square, and we tried to deal with the origins coming out of the square, which is just going to lead us into a flow. So then we come to, of course, the sermon, God's trombones. We come to the creation. And we have Val Gray Ward, you know, preaching that. Then we come to, of course, Paul Lawrence Dunbar. And we have Oni Lasana is going to rap We Wear the Mask, which is just a mind blower. She just does a great, great job with that. We're going to have Du Bois. So we're beginning to move it on up. We're going to have Langston Hughes. You know, they're stair steps. And so we just continue to bring it out. Now, when we get to the modern world, I always knew, of course, there would be Tupac, or I always knew that there would be Eleanor Greenfield, or, of course, you had to have Harlan Hopscotch. You know, how could you not have Maya? But when we get beyond, for me, beyond Tupac is about the limits. And so I had a really good crew, to use the hip-hop term. I had a really good crew to help me weed out some things because we wanted to cast as wide a net as possible.
You know, one of the examples that you have in here that is not associated with hip-hop of the modern era, but it certainly is hip-hop from an earlier generation, is the song, the collaboration between Bobby Timmons and Oscar Brown Jr., That There. And you talk about why you included that in here. Talk about that one a little bit.
Well, of course, first of all, Oscar was so important. You know, if this book had been aimed a little higher, a little older, I don't mean higher, but a little older, we would have included Bit 'Em In. Bit 'Em In, Bit 'Em In, Bit 'Em In. You know, Oscar, it was the master of the oral tradition. And of course, everybody loves That There because that's what fathers and sons do. Hey, Daddy, what That There? And I've always loved the Bobby Timmons song. So there was no way that we were going to go without Oscar. The question was, what, which one?
Hey, Daddy, what That There? And why that under there? And oh, Daddy, oh, hey, Daddy, hey, look it over there.
Now, you also have a song in here. It's called, a poem called From Ladies First by Queen Latifah. And a number of these, we should tell people that the artists themselves actually read their poetry or they perform the lyrics. And in this case, Queen Latifah does this particular song. What was it about this song that made this? Is it right to call it a song or right to call it a poetry?
It's a song. I mean, this is their music. But, of course, you know, Queen Latifah is a great girl. And, I mean, if I had a daughter or niece, you know, I certainly wanted to be Queen Latifah. But Queen Latifah broke into rap, you have to recall, at the point that it was at a time that it was really very male-oriented. And that's one reason that it was almost no doubt which one we wanted to use from her. That's going to be Ladies First.
You said that the ladies couldn't make it. You must be blind. If you don't believe what here, listen to this rhyme. Ladies First, there's no time to rehearse. I'm divine and my mind expands throughout the universe.
You call it the hip-hop speaks to children, but you also have blues in here. There's one long track blues by Sterling Brown, which is performed by Josephine Cameron, and it's it has a very nice sound to it, and it's interesting to be included in something that's titled hip hop.
Well, what would we do without the blues?
That's true.
It's the same thing that we have the Creation by James Weldon Johnson, which is a sermon. What would we do without the holiness cadence? Without bringing the way that the African Americans during slavery conveyed information, you have a people who were subject to an enforced illiteracy.
Have you done anything else like this?
No, I haven't. But the older you get, the more you realize that, and I'm just an old school teacher in my heart, or actually an old storyteller, and you think people don't really know the stories. They don't know where it comes from. People are busy. And so if I can find a way to make a book that is going to appeal to kids to want to read it, then they'll ask questions about it.
Let me ask a big favor of you, Nikki Giovanni. Would you share with us just a little of the reading of Ego Tripping? I'm looking at the words of it now. I don't know if you have it in front of you.
What
if you've
page
committed
are you? I was going to say, what page
it's
are you
on? It's
on
page 42.
Okay, thank you. I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built a Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle. So swift, you can't catch me.
That was poet Nikki Giovanni speaking to Tony Cox in our NPR West studios. Giovanni's new book is called Hip Hop Speaks to Children.
It's one thing to write a hit song. It's another to write more than a few that stand the test of time, like Bill Withers. In the 1970s, he wrote a string of love songs so emotionally on target that people want to hear them again and again. Songs like Just the Two of Us, Lovely Day, Hello Like Before, and this classic.
Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's not warm when she's away. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. And she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away.
Ain't no sunshine. Every woman that I knew before 1970 thinks that song was about her. They're all probably right.
Bill Withers is 68 now, born in West Virginia. He is the son of a coal miner. At 17, he joined the Navy and did a 9-year stint before ever deciding to get into the music business. But while Withers' songs still have legs, you hear them everywhere, his recording career frankly didn't last as long as you'd expect. Today, he says he's content with life and freely talks about his music, his career, and what happened that soured him on the music industry. He sat down with me at our NPR West studio, and I began by asking him how a black coal miner's son came to want to be a singer-songwriter.
First, you have to want to, you know, and you have to pursue it. You know, I think I was born that way. The only question was whether I was going to just do it for myself in my head or whether I was going to do it and share it with somebody else. You know what I mean?
I do.
I was up in Oakland one time at a club owned by this guy, Don Barksdale, called the Sportsman's Club, I think. And Lou Rawls was playing there. Lou came in a little late one night, so he was walking behind the bar. He says, I'm paying this guy $2,000 a week, and he can't even show up on time. And I thought, you know, $2,000 a week to come in here and sing in this joint? You know, I think I could do that.
Let's talk about some of your music. Your songs, they're personal. You talk about love. You talk about relationships. You talk about hurt feelings. There's one song in particular, and I know your wife is here, so I'm going to be careful about how I ask.
No,
this.
Go ahead.
And as I listened to it, I was thinking, you know, I wonder who this person is that Bill Withers is talking about, where you talk about an experience that everybody who's ever been with a person and is not with that person anymore goes through when they see that person for the first
hello
time.
Hello like before.
Hello like before.
A hello like before. I'd never come here if I'd known that you were here.
One of the things that I've always tried to do is to say things without all the cliches. I knew from the start we'd never part. Take my hand, I'm your hero, go to sleep. The key to that was that I had never heard anybody say that before or since. Hello, like before. People don't talk like that.
No, they don't.
Nobody ever said that but me. But you know what it means.
Absolutely.
And that's the only thing I can think of in my life that I own exclusively like that. I've never heard that phrase. And people come up, young singers, mention that song to me.
Talk about another song. Lean On Me is a song that has been played like a bajillion times. Obviously, it was the theme of the movie, and everyone has used it. But that's not a love song, is it?
Yeah.
It is?
Yeah, it's just not romantic love. It's friendship, you know. It's offering friendship.
Well, how does it feel to have written songs that have withstood the test of time? You turn on the television, there's Bill Withers' song. You go to the movies, there's a Bill Withers song. Turn on the radio, there's a Bill Withers song. How does it feel now to hear and see your work still being vital 30-some years in some cases after you created it?
It's kind of cool, actually. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I can guess.
We were laying in bed watching American Idol last night. You mentioned Lean On Me, and this kid came out, and he was doing his version of Lean On Me. That song is one of my favorites because you don't have to be a singer to sing it. People write me letters about how they're, you know, somebody died and they had a tough time and it helped them get through it. And most importantly, I can't tell you how many children told me that was the first thing they learned to play on the piano.
Really?
Because you don't have to change fingers.
Oh, see, I don't play the piano, so I wouldn't have known.
Well, I don't either. That was my piano song.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but
you had some bitter experiences with the record company in the 80s, and you made the statement that, because you sort of disappeared from the recording scene as a result of that, it appeared, and you've said that the record labels had too much power and that you would never, ever give that kind of power again, right?
Well, it was just that one company and that one guy. From 1977 until 1985, I didn't make an album. The only music that I had come out was just the two of us with Grover Washington.
Which won a Grammy, by the way.
Right, and the reason I did that song was because I couldn't get in the studio to record on my own. And there was this one guy at CBS called Mickey Eichner who actually hid from me for 2 or 3 years. He wouldn't take my phone calls if I came. And he was the head A&R guy. And I guess we didn't get along because he would make suggestions to me that I do stuff like that I should cover Elvis Presley's In the Ghetto. Well, you know, we all know the whole derivative situation. I mean, you know, I don't cover Elvis Presley. You know what I mean? I mean, let's face it. You know, without going any deeper into that, it was an affront to me as a man. I just felt confined that this one guy that really had nothing to do with any black music at all could just shut me down like that. It bothered me. So I've never signed with another record company since.
Do you think, in looking back, that was a good idea or bad idea?
It wasn't an idea. It was just that I just never got around to it, you know.
You never got around to it? What do you mean by that?
I never got around to it. I was okay, you know what I mean? I mean, I had things to do. I kept myself busy, you know what I mean? And I just never got around to it.
We all need somebody to lean on. If there is a load you have to bear that you can't carry.
Well, do you miss performing live? You
no. Did.
You don't miss it. Why not?
I don't know.
There must be. Well, but you were so good at it. I mean, I've seen you, and you seem to really, you know, relish in the moment.
Well, that was from your point of view. But from my point of view, it wasn't a good business for me because I never drew that many people. I could go play now, and it would be a better business for me now than it would have been then.
So why not do it now?
Well, because, you know, we're all shaped by how we evolve. Most people who play music for a living, they grow up doing that. I learned how to live as a sailor, actually, into my adulthood. I was in the Navy 9 years. So I learned how to live first, and then I started to play music. I'm not saying that I won't do it, you know, but I mean, it doesn't make me crazy if I'm not traveling around
and
playing
performing.
Gigs.
Looking back, we all make choices, right?
Yeah.
So I want to ask you to look at the choices that Bill Withers has made in his life to now and tell us which choice you made was your best choice and which one you made was your worst.
Let's make it a generalization thing. The best choices that I made was when I accepted who I was and was honest with myself and went about things how I believed it without worrying about whether I was going to impress somebody or not. And the worst choices that I made was when I was trying to gain somebody's approval rather than choosing on principle. And every time I compromise one of my principles, the price is fierce for that. Mm. You know, most of us can relate to that. When you compromise on your principles, you might get a rush right now, but it's going to cost you big time somewhere down the line.
3-time Grammy winner and Hall of Fame songwriter, Bill Withers.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes.